And we've been at the beach. We go on vacations and so on and so forth. And the first time it happened, she had to go to the hospital. Almost died. Windpipe closed up or whatever. She developed this allergy. A year later, I'm sure this is how it happened. We're back at the beach and she goes, "You know what? It's been almost a year since I've had some fish. I bet you'll be different next time." No, okay. Then I heard her say, of all things, "Maybe it's the people I'm eating fish with that is the problem. Or maybe it's the kind of fish that I'm eating. Or maybe it's the time of day." We laugh about it, but that's how my mind works with alcohol. She never has that. Her mind never tells her it's okay to eat fish. She knows if she does that, she's going to die. So we have an obsession with alcohol. Now, last but not least, the chart that we're handing out here. I've got it somewhere. Perfect. This proves everything that we've been talking about. Just 2 minutes. It's the disease concept of alcoholism. And by the way, like I said, the doctor's opinion has been proven. This is based on the left side, okay, the physical part, the right side mental part. Okay, one that does not drink safely or he is at dis-ease, not at ease with alcohol. 9 out of 10 people are at ease. This is based on 1 ounce per hour. If you give them a drink, one an hour, they will not get drunk. And here's what happens with us. The alcoholic, obviously, is different. Here's what happens with a non-alcoholic. Give them a drink an hour and they won't get drunk. We talked about what will happen. Here's what's happened when they have it. They are at ease. They take a drink. They have enzymes sufficient, the quantity and quality, to break down an ounce per hour. Diacetic acid and acetone. It goes into three things. This is how the body gets rid of it. Water, you know, go to the bathroom. Sugar, it's false fat, you store it. And carbon dioxide, you breathe it out. That's what happens in a non-alcoholic person. They've got the enzymes, and it's proven that they got it and breaks it down. The alcoholic has proven that obviously an ounce per hour, it takes 13 hours. So they're at a disadvantage right there. This happens in 1 hour for the non-alcoholic, but here's what really happens with the alcoholic. The enzymes that we have in our body, in sufficient quality and quantity to break it down. It breaks it down to all the things that we're talking about, but with the alcoholic, it makes a left-hand turn. That acetone turns into a physical craving, and it's proven the more acetone you have, the more you crave. So you take a drink. If you're alcoholic, your body sidetracks, and it produces acetone, and your body demands a second drink. So I give it a second drink. I got most of the acetone for the first drink. I just put a second drink. I've got all that in there, and it demands more. So once I start drinking, I can't stop because I'm satisfying a physical craving. Once again, how many times have we been at the end of the night, closing time, midnight, whatever the case is, you're all beat up, somebody ran over you, somebody beat you up in the parking lot, and some good old boy comes up and says, "Can I help you?" And you say, "My God, yes, get me another drink." I'm craving more at midnight, at 2 in the morning, than I was at 6 o'clock when I started. It's proven. So here's what happens now. Obviously, the well-known spree. Here's the headache and heartache. When I wake up the next morning, if the car is there, it's tore up, beat up, arrested, all the things that we love to talk about, I emerge restless, irritable, and discontent because I'm not drinking again. And I'm filled with guilt, shame, remorse, what I did, self-pity, and fear. I need a drink to get over my drinking. Come on, y'all. Feeling really, really bad. But remember, we quit. Willpower, we get them out over here on the right side. Sick of will, I'm done drinking. We all done that. I promise I'll never drink again. We mean it. So we have this thing called life, the emotional barometer of life. And it's not the big things. Here's the emotional barometer that gets most of us. Wake up, got to go to work every day. That bitchin' wife or that bitchin' husband. Those crying kids. My boss is a jerk. I broke my shoestrings, ran out of gas. I got to drive behind her. All the things in life. And it's building up. And it's building up. My mind says, man, you need a drink or two. I said, oh, no, I quit that. So, okay, got that. Next day, the same thing. My mind says, man, it would be nice to have a drink or two. Oh, no, I quit that. But guess what? Day after day after day, it's building up, it's building up. And one of those times, one of those thoughts get through, and I remember what alcohol did for me, not to me. I drink, I'm off and running and start the cycle. It is a proven thing. And here's what it is. It's progressive, and here's how it is. And anybody, there's a group in New York, or no, Massachusetts. They put a chair in the middle of the room. It's a disgusting meeting, by the way, or a discussion meeting, I'm sorry. They circle up the chairs, and their chair is in the middle. And I asked them, what is that chair for? They said, that chair is for anybody who had any length of sobriety, went out and it got better, and that chair is sitting empty. And the reason being is a couple reasons. This thing is called alcoholism. It's chronic, but it's progressive. And here's why it's progressive. Alcohol attacks tissue. It attacks the liver and attacks the pancreas. Guess what breaks down alcohol the most? Your pancreas and your liver. As that gets damaged, obviously your enzymes even become less. The older you get, sorry guys, but you produce less things too. Yeah, the whole thing, your whole body. So with that, the craving is harder. The body is getting weaker and it's progressive. That's why that old saying is when you start drinking again, it's not where you left, it's where you're at because it is progressive. Just because my I haven't had a drink for 29 years, if I take a drink tonight, I ain't going to be where I was at. It is progressive and it's always, always worse. This theory, the doctor's opinion, has been scientifically proven. And the point I'm trying to make is, ladies and gentlemen, to be living in this day and age, to know what alcoholism is, know what the problem is, know what the solution is, and now we have a plan of action. Thank you again for the extra 10 minutes. How about if we close with the Lord's Prayer? There, if we can, please. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. And also, we've been going with this set-aside prayer, and there's a couple different versions of it. And oddly enough, it really comes to light tonight in Bill's story about as far as the willingness, and comes up here. It's absolutely incredible and indispensable, and it is a requirement for recovery. And what we know about that is obviously most of us know enough about AA and alcoholism to be dangerous to ourselves. What we think we know can be a liability and not an asset and prevent us from learning what we need to learn and then doing what we need to do. So this prayer kind of really opens our heart, our mind, and our soul to a new perspective, if you will. And it goes as follows. God, please help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you, for an open mind and a new experience with myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. So that takes us to a newer and deeper level, if you will, in the set-aside prayer. And also, we've taken something from Bill on page 15 of this book called The 12 Steps and 12 Traditions as a mission statement, goal, mantra, what we're trying to achieve. And it goes as follows. AA's 12 Steps, a group of principles, spiritual in nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession and drink, enable the sufferer to be happily and usefully whole. Obviously, we know that is a recovered alcoholic, real deal, emotional sobriety, spiritual sobriety. That's what we're trying to achieve out of this book, where the directions are to accomplish this. Now, I, much to your surprise, have been meaning to do this. Remember where we were talking about we're going to have an acronym every week? It kind of slipped off the side, and last week we had it up there, but we didn't get it. But it was the word steps as plural. And obviously, we are going to be seeing somebody who has taken these steps, not worked them. These are the steps we took. Anyhow, steps, what does that stand for? Solutions to every problem sober, solutions to every problem in sobriety, solutions to every problem in society. Obviously, you'll see that tonight, contrary to what the fellowship may have taught you or maybe even your sponsor, what is the answer to all your problems, and don't want to break anybody's bubble, but it is not acceptance. That's a nice story that's in the back of the book. However, we will dispel that AA, that is the fellowship stuff that you hear, is not what this book talks about, but we will find out what is the answer to all of our problems tonight. And it is a absolutely fascinating thing, and knowing that and then doing it, that I guarantee you will change your life. So, last week, if you weren't here or if you were here, remember we talked about the mental obsession, and we talked about how strong a mental obsession will always, always override your willpower, self-knowledge, fear, all the things that we want to keep us from drinking, and about how strong this mental obsession is as far as the drink with the alcoholic. Obviously, who remembers your first drunk? And I think everybody probably would remember that, and obviously we chased that for a lot of years. So, and what we're saying about the obsession of the mind, I think everybody knows that, remembers that. And somebody says, well, I don't think so. I said, all right, how about who remembers their first ice cream cone? Nobody ever raised it except this one girl. She says, I remember my first ice cream cone. I said, well, you might want to go to FA or OA or whatever on there. But if you're a real alcoholic, you're going to remember. You're going to remember your first drink, your first drunk. And you will never, ever forget that. And that mental obsession will keep going and going and going. In other words, what we're trying to say, and I'll speak for myself, but probably for most of us, the obsession hasn't left. It's been changed. My mental obsession for alcohol has been removed or has been switched. And you'd be surprised on what it is. My mental obsession, like I said, since a mental obsession is always the uppermost in my mind, it hasn't left and hasn't been it has been changed. And I'll be son of a gun if what hasn't been changed to. I used to have a mental obsession to stay drunk, and buddy, I tell you what I did. There was nothing that was going to stop that. We were talking about that earlier, about almost missing our youngest daughter's birth. And that was scheduled, and it was, you know, and I knew what time to be there and whatever. And much to your surprise, I almost moved it or missed it, and that did not start the day real good when that happened. Anyhow. But anyhow, that mental obsession, now I have a mental to say, the mental obsession to stay sober. And guess what? I have since July 10th of 1987. And here's how it is for me. I think about staying sober constantly. I think about A and the solution, and almost constantly thinking, talking, or doing something for that. Now, I'll just speak for myself. In other words, always involved in the solution, which you'll find out, by the way, chapter 2 weeks, there is a solution. So it's stay in the solution, real simple, so I can stay sober. Now, if that mental obsession is not changed, my mind will remember what alcohol did for me and not what it did to me. So don't tell me what's going to happen if I drink again, because that ain't going to work. I drink no matter what. Don't tell me don't drink no matter what. That don't work. That's why I'm powerless over alcohol. That stuff, remember we talked about the frothy emotional pill, seldom suffices. Whether you give it to me, whether I give it to me, whether the whole world gives it to me, it don't work. That's why I'm powerless over alcohol. Obviously, we talked about alcoholism as a disease, and we read that set-aside prayer. Obviously, disease is not at ease with alcohol, or something that separates me from the norm. Talked about the allergy. You treat all allergies the same. You might want to write this down. Find out what you're allergic to, number one. Then number two, stay away from it. Oh, I guess that's don't drink and go to meetings. Yes, okay, yes, I got that. Okay, now, but the drawback about that is, since the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind, the obsession, we can't stay away from it. That's why we talked about earlier when it says in the first step, unmanageable. Guess what? That's a different name for the same thing of the insanity. That's why in step two, where we come to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity or manageability. The unmanageability of my life is I'm powerless over alcohol and body, mind, and soul. And no matter what I use to keep me from taking the first drink, self-knowledge, willpower, fear, bad experiences, desire, all the things that we use, it ain't going to work. It's not I can't drink. It is I will drink again and left of my own devices on self. I will drink again. That's why I'm powerless. Okay? That's what talks about on page 30. And bear with us when we get there. So that's why I'm powerless and my life's unmanageable. Okay, so since the main problem obviously centers in our mind, now we're going to go on with this story. And what we're trying to talk about here, the main problem centers in my mind, and until I found out the exact nature of alcoholism, my mind would always, always give me permission to drink again. It wasn't until I fully understood and accepted the doctor's opinion that my mind shifted gears and started looking for something else. What did it start looking for? A way to stay sober. I'll be darned. Okay, so now, obviously, that the door is closed and drinking, and like I said, my mind will find a way not to drink. So many times, and I mean this with all sincerity, we're killing people in AA a lot of different ways. And one of them is when we get up and our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. We're talking about alcoholism. We're not talking about four wives, five husbands, getting your teeth kicked down your throat, losing houses, jobs, and families. Yeah, that happens. But if we don't talk about the allergy of the body coupled with the mental obsession and spiritual malady, we're killing people out here because they are going to unidentify. How many times has it happened? Well, that can't happen to me. Oh, I only had two DUIs. This guy had six. I got four more to go. You know what I'm saying? And we're losing and we're killing people. I know it's part of our stories, but that is a sideshow of alcoholism. So what we're saying, the solution is simple once you understand the problem. Obviously, abstinence happens in the mind first, and then, of course, the body's going to follow. Abstinence happens in the mind. Mind causes the first drink. The body causes the second drink. So we got to address what the problem is. The main problem centers in our mind. Obviously, when you shut the door to drink with the doctor's opinion, obviously the second door opens up, how not to drink. And this is what we're going to do today. Now, this is a fascinating story. I want to read something that Bill wrote that really sums it up, what we were talking about. The identification versus unidentification. Bill wrote this in 1959. He goes as this. In the beginning, it was four whole years before AA brought permanent sobriety to even one alcoholic woman. Like the high bottoms, the woman said they were different. AA couldn't be for them. But as the communication was perfected, mostly by women themselves, the picture changed. The process of identification and transmission has gone on and on. The skid rower said he was different. Even more loudly, the socialite or Park Avenue stumblebum said the same. So did the artist. So did the professional people. The rich, the poor, the religious, the agnostic, the Indians, the Eskimos, the veterans, and the prisoners. But nowadays, all of these and legions more soberly talk about how much alike all of us alcoholics are down are when we admit the chips are finally down. Absolutely fascinating process about this identification. So we'd like to bring a couple things, and if you can't see it up here, crucial stuff tonight. We are going to look for in Bill's story. By the way, Bill's story is the total story of Alcoholics Anonymous. The total story. Everything from the doctor's opinion is going to flesh out, and then we are going to see the total story of Alcoholics Anonymous. Absolutely fascinating how he did this and how Bill's story got to be where it was. And it wasn't Bill's doing. I found this out by mistake when I was in New York City at the General Service Office. It was two non-alcoholics that actually kind of switched things around. Absolutely fascinating. Thank God it is where it's at, because it just, the book would be incomplete, or it wouldn't have the same effect as it does. Anyhow, we are in Bill's story, looking for identification, beginning of belief and hope. And if you don't have hope, you ain't going to be alive. Hope gets you out of bed. Now, there's a lot of hope in being hopeless. But surrender without hope defeats itself. We got to have hope. And in Bill's story, if you're a real alcoholic of the hopeless variety as my sort and as Bill, there's a whole lot of hope in there. And then, like I said, when you identify and you see you're a real alcoholic of the hopeless variety, if Bill can do it, then certainly everybody in this room can be. So obviously, we are not looking for the unidentification, and we will fill in these blanks as we go across the board here. So here's an example of why, thank God, it is what it is, this book. I'm going to go ahead and read this. Sometimes we think that alcoholics are in a class by itself. Remember, distinct entity, okay? Before we go ahead and do that, I want to bring up real quick what we did last night, last week. If you weren't here, in the doctor's opinion, these three key ideas. He said plan of recovery three times last week. Plan of recovery. So real important that I have doctor's opinion behind me. He talks about an alcoholic as hopeless. Remember, I'll be damned. Look, yeah. Item number three, hope. He talked about other methods had failed. What other methods? Everything other than the 12 steps. All other methods failed. He talked about torture. And if you're an alcoholic, you don't need an explanation what that is. You lived it. He talks about the body of the alcoholic being quite as abnormal as his mind. Allergy and obsession went at great length to do that. He talked about the allergy, used the word three times. He talked about the phenomena of craving five times. He used the word craving without the phenomena one time, so I better know what it is. He talked about the ideas. What were those? Those are the steps four times. And he used the word rules one time, in other words, those steps. Obviously, then he talks about power, capital P, which pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. We talked about earlier, frothy emotional pill seldom suffices. That's everybody, yours, mine, individually or separately. Talks about the message must have depth and weight for these alcoholics. Okay? Talks about recreating our life. I just love that. Recreating our life. Not about not drinking. It's about being reborn in the narrative of the third step. Everything. Okay? He talks about that we drink because we like the effect produced by alcohol. Real important, this next one, because you're going to see it flesh out in this guy named Bill. Can't differentiate the true from the false. Okay? Then I like this one, too. Very crucial. Sobriety or untreated alcoholism. Restless, irritable, discontent, and we look for the sense of ease and comfort a few drinks brings. Talked about the psychic change. So important tonight because you're going to see the psychic change multiple times tonight. He talked about the psychic change three times. He talked about the supreme sacrifice. We talked about that. That's either surrendering or taking your own life. And he talks about chronic alcoholics being doomed, the general opinion. So don't forget last week, we saw the problem. Step one, the powerless. We've talked briefly about the solution. The psychic change, essential psychic change is step two. Then obviously the actions necessary to get it, how to find the power, step 3 through 12. And you'll be absolutely amazed tonight how this comes out. Now, if we can, let me see here. This is the alcoholic. And if anybody thinks they were a nice guy or gal who drank too much, you might want to go back to step one. Did I say that? I did. Okay, yeah. It's far-reaching. Anyhow, I'm going to go ahead and read this. Conference approved, by the way. It says, despite most reports to the contrary, there is a growing recognition of certain common qualities which are regularly present in alcoholics, excepting those who have a frank underlying mental condition. So that would probably be all of us in the room. Characteristic of the so-called typical alcoholic, now you might want to write this down, is our narcissistic, egocentric core. How dare you? Dominated by feelings of omnipotence, really, intent on maintaining at all costs its inner integrity. While these characteristics are found in other maladjustments, they appear in relatively pure culture in alcoholic after alcoholic. In a careful study of a series of cases, We have recently reported that we felt we could discern the outlines of common character structure among problem drinkers, and the best terms could be that could find the group of qualities noted was defiant individuality and grandiosity. Oh, my God. In my opinion, those words were accurately chosen. Inwardly, the alcoholic brooks no control for man or God. He, the alcoholic, is and must be the master of his destiny. He will fight to the end to preserve that position. Now, how cool is that? All right, now, that comes from AA Comes of Age, first printing in 1957. And that was written by a psychiatrist that was really influential with Bill, a guy named Harry M. Thibault. In fact, he's mentioned in here. In 1944, Thibault wrote some articles in the American Journal of Psychiatry. The title of this paper was called The Therapeutic Mechanism of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thibault wrote four papers, if you ever get a chance and you got time and you're interested. It's absolutely fascinating. He knew us better than we knew ourselves. Anyhow, in the 99th annual meeting of the American Psychiatric Association, Detroit, in May 10th to 13th in 1943. So you're saying, what in the hell does that mean to me? Well, I'm glad that you asked that. That means, instead of reading those papers, we had better read this book, because Bill was able to took what Thibault wrote in psychiatric talk and put it in drunk talk where I can understand, and it's a matter of life and death. Somebody says, what are you talking about? Well, it's real simple. I'll tell you a little story about a non-alcoholic, a schizophrenic, and then the alcoholic. The normal guy says a tree has leaves, and he says Napoleon was a man. The schizophrenic says, okay, this has leaves, so that must be a tree. I'm a man, I must be Napoleon. That's logical, right? The alcoholic says, let me see, trees have leaves, Napoleon was a man, I'll have a drink. So now you know what we're talking about. Yeah, we're crazier than hell. I mean, that's how it is. So anyhow, he took the psychobabble and put it into stuff. I get it. I can understand and I can have the plan of recovery. Second of all, Thibault became one of AA's biggest advocates and friend. He greatly influenced Bill and taught Bill about human nature and our psychic makeup. That's why in the 12 and 12, Bill was able to go into the psyche a lot deeper. And obviously he wrote that 17 years after he wrote this. And we will, from time to time, use things out of this 12 and 12 to make a point or two. In fact, it's absolutely imperative in the third and fourth step with the explanation of that. So obviously we will go back and forth. So, the total story of Alcoholics Anonymous. Remember, the allergy can't hurt us unless we drink, but left on our own resources, we drink again. Once again, anytime there's a battle between willpower and the obsession of the mind is stronger, and it will always win. I couldn't understand when I was in that halfway house, newly sober, this old, yeah, I'd call him old timer, he was crusty, yeah, he was really, he said, kid, I said, yeah. He said, always put money on the alcohol. I said, what are you talking about? And he says, always put the money on the alcohol and not the alcoholic, because unless he has that entire or that essential psychic change, they will drink again. So in other words, obviously, we will find out the main problem, and the real problem centers in our mind telling us that we can drink. Once again, we develop that mental obsession and overrides all ideas to the contrary. That being said, we learned last week that we need the entire psychic change, the essential psychic change that Silkworth wrote about. If you weren't here, and if you were here, remember the psychic is the mind, how we think, how we feel, our ideas, our attitudes, and our emotions. So we need emotional change so we're not restless, irritable, and discontent. Because if I'm not restless, irritable, discontent, full of fear, guilt, shame, and remorse, and living a life of terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair, my mind won't be looking for the sense of ease and comfort because I've already got it. I won't want to drink. I won't have to drink because I am changed. And that's what we talked about, remember, happily and usefully whole. So, and we talked about it, it's not the big things in life, it's the small things. It's the broken shoestrings, it's your boss, it's your wife, it's your girlfriends, it's the kids, it's the dog, it's the bills, it's the news coverage. You could just go on and on and on and on. Those are the things. And once again, a good textbook won't tell you anything without backing that up with good information, and a good example is going to explain it to you. So Bill's story is a classic example, or I call it a textbook example, if you will, of the doctor's opinion, everything we've covered. So you are going to see the disease active in human life. Therefore, in Bill's story, we are going to look for, obviously, the allergy of the body. That's what they is. Doctor's opinion. We're going to see the obsession of the mind. Oh, that's right. We talked about that last week. Oh, the progression. Oh, you're going to see it tonight. It's going to come alive. You are going to see oblivion. And by the way, oblivion is a great place to be till you come back and it sucks. Because whatever you were running from, it's there, and then you created a whole lot more stuff. Oblivion is a great place, but you got to come back. Unless you die, that is. All right. And last but not least, this is so important, and thank God they put this story here. We get to see the recovery from, my God, how much the total story of Alcoholics Anonymous. Allergy, obsession, progression, oblivion, and recovery therefrom. The whole story of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how they did it with the newcomer. Don't forget, there was no 90 meetings in 90 days. There was no intergroup or whatever. They had 100 people in this book. People had to get this book in BFE. Guess what? That's how they had to get it. That's how they did it. Guess what? Bill did that with Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob got sober. They went to Bill Dotson, did the same formula. They got number 4. It kept going and going and going. That's how we did it. That's how important the story is. Therefore, Bill's story is a classic case of an Oxford visit. They used to call it our 12-step call. Most importantly, for identification, one drunk with another. Because like I said, Bill knew that this book was going to have to go to the corners of the world, and if he didn't have it right, it wasn't going to be. Identification is essential. Some say I can't identify with Bill. I suppose if you're looking for the differences, you're going to find them. And here's what they told me. They said he was old and I was not. He was a man, I was not. He was straight, I am not. He was white, I am not. He was a New York broker, I am not. You could go on and on and on and on and on from Vermont. And probably you will be right with a lot of those things. However, if you look for the differences, you will find them. If you look for the similarities, you will find them too. Therefore, we look on Bill as a hopeless, helpless, chronic alcoholic. Therefore, we look for how we drink alike. That's how that is, in those parentheses. So we look for how we drink a lot, how we think alike, how we felt alike, and how we lived alike. And if you look how you drink, think, felt, and lived, Bill's going to be your twin brother or sister, or however you want to look at it. I don't give a... You are going to be blood. This is not Bill's story. It's our story. Okay? Perfect. So, now it goes on. And if you're honest with yourself, and if you're a real alcoholic like Bill was, then you'll find out you have more in common with Bill than your differences. In other words, if you're a real alcoholic, the hopeless variety like myself, once again, this is your story. The beautiful about this, if you go to medical school and you learn something academically about illness or disease, they take you through the books and study, and I'm sure it's on the computer now, but what they do is they take you from the classroom to the hospital ward, and they will show you what you've been studying, whether that be lung cancer, childbirth, and alcoholism. So we are stepping out of the classroom, and we are going to the ward, if you will, and Bill's story. Now that we understand the problem is, he's going to give us an example in Bill's life. And not only are we going to see the problem, but we get to see his recovery too. So we will get to see. What do we get to see? His disease. Remember, we're stepping out. We'll get to see the progression of his disease. Most importantly, we get to see the recovery from his disease. This isn't just a fancy, nice little story to put in the beginning of the book to fill up pages. This is so powerful. Bill was a good man. Not a saint, not a Superman. He was a real alcoholic, the hopeless variety. Him and Dr. Bob were ordinary people that God used to do something extraordinary. Nothing more, nothing less, nothing else. They would be the first one to tell you. A little bit of Bill's character, if you will, and you'll see how it comes alive because we're not going to be able to stop in the story. Bill was optimistic, hardworking, self-made man, a lot of willpower, strong desire to see, okay, to succeed. He has so much willpower. He taught himself how to play a violin. He was tone deaf. He taught himself to play baseball. He was not athletic, but when he put his mind to it, he did the deal. And I mean, this guy was a self-made man. Here's where Bill came from, and you'll see, and it'll come to life real quick. From Vermont, a little town in Vermont, born behind a bar, and obviously in a hotel. It's kind of cool. Bill's dad and his grandpa, paternal side, were alcoholic. Bill's dad left him when he was young, went up to Canada, and really didn't see too much of him after that. Bill's mom left him left for New York City with his sister. He was just a kid when that happened. So Bill was raised by his mother's parents and his their grandparents. And that was a small town called East Dorset. Bill had very humble beginnings. He went to a military school called Norwich Academy in Vermont. But he had met Ebby at a middle school called Burr and Burton Academy. Here's a picture of it if you would so choose to look. It's absolutely fascinating up there. Burr and Burton, it's really weird how it all falls out. A lot of his story, he talks about this golf course that's Equinox right across the street where Ebby comes into the picture. His family home was right down the street. It's all like, it's even closer than it is in Akron with all the historical things. It's absolutely fascinating. And is that odd or is it God? But anyhow, he met Ebby Thatcher, we'll talk about in prep school, called Burr and Burton. There's another guy up here. We'll see these guys here, and it's I didn't change my names, but no, this is Ebby Thatcher we're talking about. We're talking about Roland Hazard. He was a very big part of this, member of the Oxford group, and he got the solution, or step two, if you will, step two, the religious idea, from a psychiatrist, non-alcoholic, Carl Jung in Switzerland, what we find out later is the vital spiritual awakening experience. Roland was a Rhode Island senator, investment banker, and a senior director of Standard Oil. Big, big wig. Roland Hazard and this guy named Shep Cornell and Seber Graves were in the Oxford group, and they came at Ebby's hearing when they were going to probate Ebby for his drinking. Another thing that's influenceable about this tonight is a book called The Common Sense of Drinking strongly influenced Bill in the writing of the big book. Contrary to what everybody thinks, that saying God as you understand him, that came from the Oxford group. You will see where Ebby gave that to Bill. And obviously we know how important that is to so many of us. Now, this Ebby Thatcher, this guy's real name was Edwin Throckmorton Thatcher. Now, if that wouldn't make you drink, I don't know what would. So anyhow, here's Ebby. He came from a prominent family in Albany, New York. Ebby's dad was mayor of Albany. Ebby's family, they were well-to-do, owned the foundry from 1852 to 1922. Ebby knew Bill since 1910, so they go way, way, way back. Ebby's family used to vacation in Manchester, Vermont, which is just a little bit of south of East Dorset. That's how they end up meeting together, obviously. They vacationed there. Ebby and Bill were in school together in 1912. Ebby came from a hard-drinking family, especially his dad and his brother. But Ebby was the worst out of all of them. He was the black sheep of the family, always in trouble, got kicked out of school, got kicked out of the house. He even got kicked out of the National Guard. That does something back then. Ebby's mother died in 1927. His dad died in 29. After they both died, he received a large inheritance. But like most people, he lost half of it in the stock market, and the other half he lost on wild living. The Oxford group, and we'll talk about this, obviously, our history, had Ebby start talking, or testimony, if you will, 2 weeks sober. Interesting. Ebby was 6 to 8 weeks sober when he called on Bill, and we'll see how that fleshes out tonight. Here's about Ebby. Ebi did not stay sober. The longest period he had in this whole period of time was 6 years. He would stay sober for maybe a total of 15 or 16 years off and on. He would get 7 or 8 months and drink again. In the summer of 1953, he went to Texas to try to get sober. Ebi died March 21st, 1966. By the way, he was sober, and it was really kind of odd. The guy who brought so much to Alcoholics Anonymous, there were only 12 people at his funeral. Got to hear or met one of the ladies that was there. Is that odd or is it God? And obviously Bill and Lois were there, this woman, and there was just a handful of people at Ebi's funeral. Obviously, Bill always called Ebi my sponsor. Bill, for what it's worth, I don't know why I put it in here, but he was 43 when he wrote this book, and one time I thought that was old. I wish I could say that now, but yeah. Better keep on going. The time's a-ticking. Bill was asking in an interview if he could have anything, what would it be? Without hesitation, Bill said it would have been sobriety for Ebi, because it just troubled him. He just loved Ebi to death, and Bill always had a heavy heart about that. In fact, Bill requested that Ebi receive a monthly check for life off the proceeds of the book. Obviously, that didn't happen. Dr. Bob and Bill did, because they gave their lives to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they got a small thing to stay alive. Here's what's so important. Heard this on a tape. This is out of the horse's mouth. Here is the prescription for sobriety. Ebi to Bill, the bottom line. This is what he said. Trust God, clean house, help others. Ebi told Bill 4 things. Get honest with yourself. Talk it out with another person. Make restitution to people you might have harmed. Pray to whatever God you know. Also, this is what he told Bill too. He said, honesty with oneself of a kind I'd never had before. Complete honesty with someone else. Straightening out all my twisted relationships the best I could. Give of myself to help someone else in need. And prayer was necessary for sobriety. Ebi gave Bill 2 important things, and thank God, because we wouldn't be here. The need for the vital spiritual awakening, spiritual experience. We talked about that. That's step 2. You'll see it come alive from Carl Jung. And also he gave him a simple program or procedure to do that, which turns out to be steps 3 through 12. 2 more essential ideas he gave Bill. The need for identification, one alcoholic to another. We'll call that the language of the heart. And the need for strenuous work with others. So how did this end up getting in where it was at? Bill's business partner, Hank, who wrote the chapter to the employers, met with Janet Blair, an editor from New York, in mid-38. In November of 1938, Hank wrote to Janet, and this is her name, Janet Blair, about Bill's progress, revealing Bill should be finished with the writing by December 19th. Meanwhile, another editor, Tom Uzel, is contacted to work on the format. According to Bill, Tom Uzel, quote, this is Bill's language, sharpened up the English but didn't change much of anything, excepting to take my story out of the story section where it had been the number one story and insisted on using it to open the book. What is now chapter 2, I had intended to be chapter 1. The quote is significant because it reveals to us that in the early manuscript, Bill's story appeared in the personal story section, and it was Tom Uzel who moved Bill's stories to chapter 1. Well, I'll tell you what, if you don't believe God's hand was in every page of this and how this was formulated, absolutely fascinating. Let's see about Bill's story. Great, great story. Okay, Bill's story. I believe that's on page number 1 now. Yes. Everybody on page number 1, Bill's story. War fever, and that is, by the way, World War I. And right now, yeah, what is this, 2017? Yeah, World War I is 100 years old going on right now. It's from 1914 to 1918. Anyhow, a little trivia. War fever ran high in the New England's town. And that happened to be New Bedford, Massachusetts, to which new young officers from Plattsburgh were assigned. Plattsburgh is an army station up in upstate New York. And we were flattered when the first citizens took us in their homes. making us feel heroic. Here was love, applause, war, moments sublime with intervals hilarious. What the hell is that? Okay, I'm glad that you asked, okay? Don't you love the way Bill writes, okay? Moments sublime are obviously noble, exalted, inspiring, awe, admiration. So here he was saying, obviously in the war, that and some funny moments. Listen, this is a key of an alcoholic coming up. I was part of life at last. In other words, something was missing from the get-go. He needed the thrill. In other words, life isn't, I'm not happy because of what's going on. I'm happy because I'm in life. And Bill, something's already missing. He hasn't started drinking yet, but you'll see his personality. Okay? And it says, in the midst of the excitement, I discovered liquor. Uh-oh. I forgot strong warnings. Remember I told you about his dad and his grandfather, bad alcoholics. And the prejudice over my people concerning drink. They said, whatever you do, Bill, keep away from that. You got the X factor or the chromosome in there. And Bill said, I ain't going to do that. But guess what? He did. In time, we sailed for over there. That happens to be Europe. He got out of that Norwich Academy, came out as an officer. Actually, FYI, Norwich was really the first West Point. In fact, it's still up and going today, but it was the first West Point Academy, if you will. That's where a lot of officers are still pumping them out today. Anyhow, it says, there I was very lonely and again turned to alcohol. You can see right from the get-go that that is the solution. It's his lover if he's lonely and so on and so forth. You can say he's setting the table. Okay, we landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved. Took me a long time to figure out what much moved. You know what that was? He had a spiritual experience there. And he refers to it three times. Much moved. I wandered outside. My attention was caught by a doggerel on an old tombstone. And obviously a doggerel is a comic verse. And here's what it said. Here lays a Hampshire grenadier. That happens to be a regiment that throws hand grenades. Pretty clever, right? Okay. Who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is neither forgot whether he died by musket or by pot. And that is not reefer. That's how they used to. Yeah, outside issues, no. That's what, and no, it's not. That's how they used to drink beer out of a pot. Now, FYI, here's Bill and his regiment, and here is the tombstone. My understanding is when you get over there, a lot of those AAs go over and see this tombstone, and unfortunately, they're probably doing what they're doing at Dr. Bob's. Some selfish, self-centered alcoholics think they have the right to chip away a tombstone. And unfortunately, that's happening over at Mount Peace Cemetery, and we ain't got time to go there with that. I don't think you want to hear my thoughts on that. But anyhow, here's what happens. Ominous warning, which I failed to hear. Ominous, that's like Darth Vader. It's evil, omen, threatening. 22 and a veteran of foreign years, I was home at last. I fancied myself as a leader. Uh-oh, Bill, he thinks pretty high of himself. For I had not my men of battery give me a special token of my appreciation. The men really liked him. They chipped together when the war was over, and they bought him a ring and a watch chain. Usually they want to shoot your commanding officer in the back, friendly fire on purpose, right? Or accident, you know how it is, but they liked him. So anyhow, Bill says, my talent, you can see he likes himself, for leadership, I imagine, would place me at the head of vast enterprises, which I would imagine with utmost insurance. He would become the head alky or the head of Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, here's Bill's personality. I took a night law course that happened to be at Brooklyn Law School, and he actually got a degree. But here's how alcoholic he was. He never went, even picked up the hard copy of that. I mean, who else but an alcoholic would graduate and not bother to do that? But anyhow, took a night law course and obtained employment as investigator for a surety company. That's something that makes sure protects responsible for, obviously, others. The drive for success was on. I'd proved to the world that I was important. Isn't there every alcoholic in here? Isn't that how we get our self-worth, is what you think of me or what I think you think of me? It's not what I am to me and my God. It's what you think about me. You can see all these. Remember the definition, T-Bowl, of the alcoholic? He's coming alive, okay? And he goes on to say, My work took me about Wall Street little by little, and became interested in the market. Many people lost money, but some became very rich. Why not I? I studied economics and business as well as law. Potential alcoholic, can't differentiate the truth and false that I was. I nearly failed my law course. At one of the finals, I was too drunk to think or write. That would be a good idea, I guess. Though my drinking was not yet continuous, Y-E-T, it disturbed my wife. Somebody said, that's a typo. I said, what are you talking about? It said, it disturbed my wives. This guy had about four or five of them, but anyhow. He said, we had long talks when I would steal her forebodings, and that is foretell or predict, usually evil, by telling her that men of genius conceive their best projects when drunk, that the most majestic constructions of philosophical thought were so derived. Wow. We alcoholics, obviously, fast-talking to slow-thinking people. No offense to any Al-Anons in here, but yeah, she took it. She got it. Okay. Now, by the time I completed the law and completed the course, I knew that law was not for me. The inviting maelstrom, and that is an agitated state of mind or affairs, of Wall Street had me in its grip. Business and financial leaders were my heroes. Out of this alloy of drink and speculation, I commenced to forge the weapon that one day would turn in its flight like a boomerang and all but cut me to ribbons. There's a story behind the story on that, and this goes as, if you ever get up to East Dorset, go to the house where Bill grew up. They took his, it's not the original one, but anyhow, his grandfather brought home a book and said the only one that can build a boomerang, a rib, how do you say it in Australia, what is the native?
Aborigines.
Thank you. They were the only ones that could build a boomerang. And Bill said, oh, you don't tell me I can't do it. Anyhow, this, as a kid, he worked for 6 months, day and night on it. He even took his headboard and cut it out. And they got it up there where they cut a thing out. It's pretty cool. But I'll be damned if he didn't do it, and he did. He was able to make a boomerang, and he threw it, and it came around the churchyard, which is right there in between the inn. There's a church and where Bill grew up, and you'll see about that. Anyhow, that was the type of personality that Bill had. So when he talks about the boomerang, there's a story behind the story. And when he talks about some other things, I'll bring up the stories. It's absolutely fascinating, and it makes a lot of things. So that boomerang all but cut me to ribbons. He said, living modestly, my wife and I saved $1,000 and went into certain securities, then cheap, rather unpopular. I rightly imagined that someday they'd have a great rise. I failed to persuade my broker friends to send me out looking over factories and managements, but my wife and I decided to go anyhow. Another story in itself. Bill had a gift to see in the future. Everybody was making money in stocks, buy it, sell it, and everything. Bill said, someday this bubble is going to burst. We're buying stuff we don't know nothing about. And one of these days, this is going to come tumbling down. The who's who on Wall Street said, Bill, you're out of your mind. We're making enough money. I don't think your ideas are any good. We don't need you. We don't want it. Don't tell that to an alcoholic, because guess what? He's going to go ahead and do it. And that's what they did. Now listen to what they said. Okay. He said, you need to investigate these companies. You need to have reports. You need to see what you're buying. And they said, go fly a kite. So anyhow, he said, I decided to go anyhow. He said, I developed a theory that most people lost money in stocks through ignorance on markets. I discovered many more reasons later on. We, meaning Lois and Bill, gave up our positions. Off we roared on a motorcycle. Yes, it was a Harley, and yes, this is a picture of them on the Harley. It's a picture of him driving it, but usually he was too drunk, and Lois was usually driving that thing. That's a true story. Now, it's weird. Bill did it for the money. Lois was doing it to get him out of New York City because she was already in tune. This guy was in trouble with his drinking. Lois loved him, and she went to hell and back. In fact, they went real quick. If we have this, 52 times after he got sober, they moved before they got stepping stones. 52 times sober. I don't think all you girls together could get 52 times, much less separately. But anyhow, she knew he was in trouble from the get-go. So anyhow, they stuffed the sidecar stuff with tents, blankets, a change of clothes, three huge volumes of financial references. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. Perhaps they were right. I had some success on speculation, so we had a little money. So we had a little money. But once we worked on a farm for a month, avoid drawing on our small capital. And that farm was owned by a lady named Ella Goldfoot. Listen to what he says. That was the last honest manual labor on my part for many a day. He alcoholic there. So what they did, says we covered the whole eastern United States in a year. They did the 100 biggest companies, top to bottom, and Bill got in. He talked to the employees. He even got in the plants. He even got with the workers and whatever. Started saying, this is what this company is. This is what they do. This is what they have and they don't have. He started sending this back to Wall Street, the people that said we don't need it. They looked at it and said, oh, my God, this is perfect. This is exactly what you're looking for. You are a brainchild. And look at what happened with that. So Bill was always ahead of the curve in a lot of different ways, especially before this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyhow, he said at the end of it, my reports were all Wall Street, procured me a position there and the use of a large expense account to exercise an option, brought in more money, leaving us with a profit of several thousand dollars for that year. Don't forget, this is back in the 20s and thousands was a lot more than it is now. For the next few years, fortune threw money and applause my way. Now, here's a real alcoholic. I had arrived. Now, we all think that one way or another, especially when we're locked up, right, or sleeping out in the cardboard box. But anyhow, it says, my judgment and ideas were followed by many to the tune of paper millions. The great boom of the late 20s was seething and swelling. Seething is surge violently or an agitated state. Drinking was taking an important and exhilarating part in my life. Remember, see his disease and the progression. Won't stop every time, but you can see him progressing right now. Okay, there was a lot of talk at the jazz places uptown. Everyone spending thousands and chattering millions. Scoffers could scoff. What is a scoffer? Somebody who jeers, somebody who shows contempt, somebody who shows disregard. Scoffers could scoff and be damned. I made a host of fair-weather friends. Uh-oh. I like this one. My drinking assumed more serious proportions. You can see it progressing. Continuing all day and almost every night. Got it now. Now, how many of this has happened to us? The remonstrances of my friends terminated in a row and I became a lone wolf. What is a remonstrance? Is object, say, with protest. In other words, they're saying, Bill, you're drinking too much. Bill, when I go out with you, my wife gets mad at me. Bill, when I go out with you, we end up in jail. And you know what we say? To hell with you. I don't need you. And we move on to the next level. And we get to the point in time where, to hell with all of you. I don't need anybody. All I need is my drinking. You can see that, obviously, Bill's a real alcoholic. Then he goes on to say, there were many unhappy scenes in our sumptuous apartment. He was making so much money. Real estate, especially in Manhattan, is a prime, always has been. He had enough money to buy the apartment, buy the one next to, and he knocked down the wall. They had one of the biggest places in Manhattan. But he said there was many unhappy scenes in that, so money isn't everything, so obviously we'll see what happens. This next sentence, I believe about everything that Bill wrote, but Bill wrote a book as Bill sees it, and Lois wrote a book as Lois remembers, and they aren't always the same. And here's what I'm saying on this. It says, there had been no real infidelity, for loyalty to my wife helped at times by extreme drunkenness and kept me out of those scrapes. Okay, anyhow, we won't take debate with that. In 1929, happened to be the spring, by the way, I contracted golf fever. We went at once out to the country. My wife applauded while I started to overtake Walter Hagen. Walter Hagen was the golfer at that time. It would have been the Tiger Woods of that, Jack Nicklaus, Ben Hogan. He was a who is who in golf at that time. But here's what he says. Liquor caught up with me much faster than I came up behind Walter. I began to be jittery in the morning. Progression. And this is why we all golf, right? Golf permitted drinking every day and every night. Well, now, come on, let's go, man, let's go. Okay, it was fun to roam around the exclusive course, and that's that Equinox Country Club in Manchester, Vermont. Like I said, almost across the street from Burr and Burton here. Anyhow, It was fun to come around the exclusive course, which had inspired such awe in me as a lad. I acquired the impeccable coat of tan. That's without defect, error, perfect, or flawless. Okay, as one sees on the well-to-do. The local banker watched me whirl in fat checks in and out of his till with amused skepticism. Abruptly, October 1929, that happened to be Thursday, October 24th, called Black Thursday. That's when the market crashed. Anyhow, abruptly in October 29th, hell broke loose on the New York Stock Exchange. Then, by the way, on October 29th, it happened again Tuesday. That's why I couldn't get it when he said this next one. He said, after one of those days, okay, probably both of them, the 24th and the 29th, of Inferno, I wobbled from a hotel bar to the brokerage office. You know what you're going to drink when the world's come craving it. You're going to drink, right? Okay. It was 8 o'clock, five hours after the market closed. The ticker still clattered. I was staring at the inch of tape, which bore the inscription XYZ32. That happened to be Pennock and Ford Corn Products. What that meant was it had been 52 that morning. I was finished, and so were many of my friends. The papers reported men jumping to death from high towers of finance. And that's no exaggeration. They were jumping out of buildings in New York City because guess what? They lost it all. Listen to what he said. That disgusted me. I would not jump. I went back to the bar. Oh, hell yeah. Come on, man. So I was a millionaire, and now I ain't got nothing. Give me a drink, remember? Yeah, the regular person, the schizo, and the alcohol. Okay, I get it, all right. My friends had dropped several million since 10 o'clock. So what? Tomorrow was another day. As I drank, the old fierce determination to win came back. Sit down and think about it. How many of us been in the divorce court? You come out after that, where do you go? You go to the bar, and then you start thinking, oh, she ain't going to treat me, or he ain't going to treat me like that. In front of the judge, get out of that. Oh, they're not going to treat me like that. Out of wherever you're at, and you start drinking, and it starts going through you. Remember, it's the solution, y'all. It ain't the problem. And he says the first fierce determination win came back. Next morning, I telephoned a friend in Montreal. Actually, this turned out to be Lois's idea. Once again, just like how Lois with the going to the whole Eastern United States. He had plenty of money left and thought I'd better go to Canada. His friend happened to be in Montreal, Canada, and it was Dick Johnson of the firm Grease Shields and Company. The Depression hadn't made it to Canada yet, okay? So anyhow, it says he had plenty of money left and thought I'd better go to Canada. By the following spring, we were living in our custom style. I felt like Napoleon returning from Elba. No St. Helena from me. Listen, he went from nothing to a millionaire, lost it in the stock market, went back to poverty again. Now he's back up again. Not too many people can do that. That's the kind of person Bill was in his personality. Okay. Anyhow, it says, but drinking caught up with me again. And my generous friend had to let me go. This time we stayed broke. How about those agains are a hell of a lot worse than some of those yets. Again. Again. And again. Oh, that's right. That's the definition of chronic. Okay. So now listen what it says, and you can see the progression. It says, we went to live with my wife's parents. Uh-oh, that ain't no fun, is it, guys? Okay. I found a job, then lost it as a result with a brawl with a taxi driver. Now here's a millionaire getting in a fight with a taxi cab driver over what? I don't know. Who knows? Mercifully, no one would guess that I could have no real employment for 5 years or hardly draw a sober breath. Progression. My wife began to work in department store. That happens to be, actually, she worked at Macy's from 1931 to 1934. In 1934, she went to Lesser's department store. Anyhow, she was forced to work. Coming home exhausted to find me drunk. This is important, what's coming in progression. I became an unwelcome hanger-on at the brokerage place. Don't forget, he was the fair-haired child on Wall Street. He went from the golden child and everybody following where he would come into these places and say, Bill, you can't come here. Bill, you stink. Your clothes are tore up. You're unshaven. You're shaking and whatever. You can't come here. We don't want you here anymore. So he went from the penthouse to the outhouse, and now his even own people on Wall Street won't have anything to do with him. Listen to this one. Liquor ceased to be a luxury. It became a necessity. So now we went from fun to necessity. Bathtub gin. Don't forget this is prohibition. 2 bottles a day and often 3 got to be routine. Sometimes a small deal would net a few $100 and I would pay my utilities. Come on, y'all know. I would pay my bills at the bar and delicatessens. He was working to drink and drinking to work. We know all that drill. Okay. And this went on endlessly. And I began to awaken very early in the morning, shaken violently. So now it went from jittery, remember, in the morning, to now he's shaken violently. Remember the whole thing that we were talking about all on this board here. Okay, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. And it says, a tumbler full of gin followed by a half dozen bottles of beer would be required if I were to eat any breakfast. This guy is, he's starting to go down physically, you can see it. Now listen to this. This is a crucial part from the doctor's opinion. We can see he's going to hell in a handbasket. We can see he's starting to die from alcoholism, but listen to what his mind told him. Nevertheless, I still thought I could control the situation. Perfect, okay? Now, look how sick he was. And there were periods of sobriety which renewed my wife's hope. Gradually, things got worse. Progression. Here's what happened. The house was taken over by the mortgage holder. My mother-in-law died, and my wife and father-in-law became ill. His father-in-law was a doctor named Dr. Clark Burnham. They were quite well off. Obviously, that's how they had the home up in Manchester. That's how Lois and Bill met at Emerald Lake. His mother-in-law's name was Matilda Spellman Burnham. They came from a lot of money, a doctor and doctor's wife in New York City. Anyhow, here's what happened. Then I got a promising business opportunity. Stocks were at a low point of 1932, and I had somehow formed a group to buy. I was to share generously in the profits. That actually happened to be two guys that put this together that had the money. Somebody in the name of A. Wheeler and somebody in the name of F. Winans. What it was is they came up with the idea if everybody pulled their money together, obviously together we got a lot more than individually, and they were going to buy stocks and everybody's going to pull their money, buy it, sell it, and become money. They knew Bill was good at doing that. They said, Bill, we're going to hire you. You do this under one condition, you don't drink. Bill said, I'm done with that drinking. So they're getting ready to ink the deal. They were in a hotel the night before it happened. Somebody pulled out a bottle, it was prohibition, a bunch of them around the table, and goes around. Bill gets it. No, I'm not drinking today. Goes around again, goes to Bill. Bill said, no, I'm not drinking again. Somebody says, Bill, this is some of the finest Applejack liquor you've ever had. And it's called Jersey Lightning. Bill's mind said, Jersey Lightning, I've never had that before. Took one drink. One drink. What happened? Oh, that's right. The phenomenon of craving became paramount. Remember I told you last week in the doctor's opinion there was going to be a story to back this up? This is a story. Listen to what happens after he took that one drink. Then I went on a prodigious bender. That's enormous or huge. And the chance vanished. Now here's the magic that comes up. When he woke up, he said, this had to be stopped. Now he can differentiate the true from the false. Now he says it's the liquor that's doing it. So what do? We get out our most important weapon, willpower. Say, sick him, Will. All right, so now, and Bill, now look at the willpower this guy did. Made the boomerang, played the violin, the baseball cap, all the things that you couldn't do or impossible to do. He did all that. He's probably got more strong self-will than most of us in this room. Let's see what happened to Bill with the self-will, the strong will that he wanted. Okay, he said, I saw that I could not so much take as one drink. I was through forever. You know how that is. I'm done. Before then, I'd written lots of sweet promises. If you get a chance, go see Stepping Stones. Those sweet promises are written on the family's Bible. Now, if you are lucky enough to even get close to the family Bible, you're doing good. If you are lucky enough to let your wife write promises in the Bible, you're really doing good. He wrote, October 20th, 1928, Thanksgiving 1928, January 1929, and September 3rd of 1930. He swore on the family Bible and his love to Lois and to God and everything, I'm done drinking. That's what about the sweet promises. Dude, you don't be writing that in the Bible unless you mean it from your heart of hearts, because you ain't going to do that, because you're going to be guilty as proven. And guess what? Those were the sweet promises he meant, and he meant them from the bottom of his heart. They had a love for each other. It was just unbelievable, Bill and Lois. And that's why we're talking about those sweet promises. But anyhow, my wife happily deserved it this time. I meant business, and I did. Let's see what happens with old willpower. Shortly afterwards, I came home drunk. Oh. Uh-oh. Promise number one gone. Okay. All right. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? That's a fancy name for willpower. I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I'd taken it. Was I crazy? Yes, we will find out more about alcoholism, chapter 3. That's what that whole chapter is about. And it would be a form of insanity if I can't do what I want to do, or I'm doing things I don't want to do, I would be classified as insane. This is what he's saying. He's starting to wonder if he's crazy, okay? Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. What is appalling? It's horrify. It's shock. It's dismay. He couldn't believe that this happened to him, because he was done forever for good. You know, like I said, what did he do again? Renewing my resolve, my willpower, I tried again. Okay, let's see what happens this time. Sometime past, the confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. That is, too sure, conceited, or arrogant. I could laugh at gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into the cafe to telephone. In no time, I was beating on the bar asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk, and I did. All right, everybody knows real alcoholic there. Some people say alcoholics are weak will. That is not true. A non-alcoholic, after they puke 3 times, will quit drinking. Us alcoholics, I was saying, there's got to be a way we can do it without drinking. So Bill had a lot of willpower. Let's see what happens. Beautiful description. Nobody needs a Webster's of this. The remorse, the horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. I would say he's getting close to step one there. Getting close. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. I suppose that's when you hear in the fellowship when they talk about impending doom. I don't know what that is, because it's not in this book. Impending calamity is different. I suppose that's how we've transposed it. I don't know. I don't know, but I suppose that's what it might be. But he goes on to say, here's why. I hardly dare cross the street lest I collapse and be run down by an early morning truck, for it was scarcely daylight. And see where he is tore up. An all-night place supplies me with a dozen glasses of ale. My withering nerves were still at last. What is withering? Great emotional stress. Doesn't he use the right language at the right time? Like I said, Bill is a master of the English language. Yes, thank you, Chris, for doing that. And by the way, don't let me get out of here without the master of what he's talking about, willingness and how it comes. It's so imperative. So anyhow, he goes on to say this. A morning paper told him the market had gone to hell. Well, so had I. The market would recover, but I wouldn't. That was a hard thought. Should I kill myself? No, not now. Then a metal fog settled down. Gin would fix that. Come on, y'all. I love it. So 2 bottles and oblivion. So you can see progressing. Listen to what he says. He saves us some time. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms, for mine endured this agony 2 more years. He's going to save us a lot of time here. Sometimes I stole from my life's slender purse when the morning terror and madness were on me. Again, I swayed dizzily before an open window over the medicine cabinet where there was poison, cursing myself for a weakling. He wanted to kill himself and take poison, but he couldn't do it. He couldn't even do that. How many of us have thought that? Now, listen to what it says. There were flights from the city to the country and back. Obviously, those were short geographic cures. Lois always wanted to get him out of New York and Wall Street and whatever. That was the problem. They were always running up and forth to Vermont, and it didn't work. Listen to what it said. Okay, as my wife and I sought escape, then the night came where the physical and mental torture was so hellish I feared I would burst through my window, sash, and all. Somehow I managed to drag a mattress down the lower floor lest I suddenly leap. Listen to what alcoholism is, y'all. It ain't about drinking too much and getting in trouble. He says it's remorse, horror, hopelessness, agony, terror, madness, torture, hellish. I got it now. That's alcoholism. It's not about drinking too much and doing a weekend in jail. That's kid stuff. We're talking about alcoholism there. Okay, so now he goes on to say, a doctor came in with a heavy sedative. Next day found me both drinking gin and sedative. That was a good chaser, wasn't it? Okay. This combination soon landed me on the rocks. People feared for my sanity. So did I. I could eat little or nothing when drinking. I was 40 pounds underweight. You can see this guy is about dead. All right, now listen to what it says. My brother-in-law, a guy named Dr. Strong that was married to Bill's sister, and my brother-in-law is a physician, and through his kindness and that of my mother, I was placed in a nationally known hospital for the mental and physical rehabilitation of alcoholics. Obviously, Towns Hospital, Dr. Silkworth, that we talked about. That happens to be in the summer of 1933. Under the so-called Belladonna treatment, my brain cleared. Belladonna was a nightshade, a drug that would keep you going from DTs. They called it the purge and puke. They would give you that medicine and you would puke, and hopefully that would cure your alcoholism. Another thing they did is hydrotherapy and mild exercise helped much. Hydrotherapy is where they would strap you on a gurney, take you into this room. There was many shower heads. Hot and cold water would spray on you, and they would take you in there for a half hour or 45 minutes. Did not cure alcoholism, but you came out a clean drunk. So.